Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figter, associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Elaine Landamore. We will be talking about her new book, Democratic Reason: Politics, Collective Intelligence, and the Rule of the Many, which has just been published with Princeton University Press. Elaine is assistant professor of political science at Yale University. We're all probably familiar with the thought that democracy is merely the rule of the unwise mob. In the hands of Plato and a long line of philosophers following him, this thought has been developed into a formidable anti-democratic argument. Only truth or wisdom confers political authority. And since democracy is the rule of the unwise mob, it has no authority whatsoever. Now, this rough line of argument has proven so formidable that, in fact, many democratic theorists have tried to evade it by explicitly denying that politics has anything at all to do with wisdom. But there's another strand of democratic theory that takes the argument by the horns and tries to show that democracy is indeed epistemically sound. Now, some of these views try to show that democracy, warts and all, is wiser than the alternatives. But others have gone further to try to show the more ambitious claim that democracy has a positive epistemic value. In Democratic Reason, Elaine Landamore pursues this more ambitious path. She argues that empirical data pertaining to the epistemic significance of cognitive diversity show that democracy is uniquely placed to supply distinctive epistemic social goods. Along the way, she explores a range of current findings regarding the wisdom of crowds and also engages core issues at the heart of normative political theory. This is an exciting and comprehensive contribution to democratic theory. So we turn to the interview. Hello, Elaine Landamore.
Hello, Bob.
How are you doing today?
I'm great. And you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for joining us on New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, everyone, today on New Books in Philosophy, my guest is Elaine Landamore, and we'll be talking about her new book, Democratic Reason, which is just published with Princeton University Press. Now, I highly recommend this book because it provides what I regard as a very careful and compelling defense of the idea that democracy can be justified on epistemic grounds. Landamore, that is, adopts a crucial premise that drives many familiar anti-democratic views, and she effectively turns the tables on them, arguing, in effect, that a democratic social order makes possible a certain kind of expertise. This is, of course, I think you'll recognize a bold thesis. And so there's a lot to discuss. But before we get into those details, Elaine, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I guess I'm French. You note that from my accent immediately. I come from Normandy, from a town called Caen, C-A-E-N, it's spelled. People always get it confused with Cannes, but I assure you it's not nearly as glamorous. So
no film festivals?
No film festivals. So I became interested in philosophy, I suppose, in my last year of high school, because in France, philosophy becomes part of the curriculum in high school in your last year. And it was truly a revelation to me. I really, really enjoyed it. I was at the time in a very scientific curriculum, so it was just a great contrast, and it felt more like a natural home to me than physics or chemistry, even though I did like mathematics a lot. So sure. I suppose the main question I had at the time, that sort of made me love philosophy, was why should we act morally? Like, why are the reasons if we don't believe in God, among other things, what motivation should we have to act morally? And behind that question, I realized later on, I also had an interest in a more social scientific question, which is like, why do we make the choices we make? So it was more of a positive question behind that, I think has come to become even more dominant in my interest. So I did my undergraduate and part of my graduate studies in Paris. When I moved there when I was 18, where I studied moral philosophy and epistemology at the École Normale Supérieure. Mm-hmm. And I also studied at Sciences Po Paris, where I took the unusual decision, I suppose, at least for a philosopher, to major in economics and finance rather than public service. These are the two sort of, but I had this nagging feeling that maybe, you know, I should have looked into more world-oriented professions. And so, I don't know, I was interested in economics and finance. And then that's when I became exposed to game theory and rational choice theory and economic theory in general. And I remember being absolutely mesmerized by game theory in particular, and all the game theoretical trees and matrices and also the concept of the prisoner's dilemma, for example. I thought there was something extremely elegant and clear in this approach, in this way of modeling human choices and showing how, you know, strategic interactions between perfectly rational individuals can yield socially suboptimal outcomes. So I had this like brief total fascination for it, and then I became much more critical, of course, like most people become. I decided to write my dissertation on the philosophy of economics, and it was supposed to be a much more sort of a criticism of rational choice theory, really. So, so I should also mention maybe that just before I did that, before I turned to the philosophy of economics, I had written a master's thesis on the notion of probability in David Hume. So I think this all connects in a way. Looking back, I realize that this you know, there's a sort of almost clear path to my current interests. And in Hume, I was trying to complicate the classical picture of Hume as an irrationalist, in a way, for somebody for whom reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions, right? So right. I was trying to show that no, reason has some role to play, in particular through the distinction between philosophical and non-philosophical probabilities. You can sort of clarify what kind of ends are worth pursuing and what kind of ends are not worth pursuing. So it's not entirely, it's not the picture of Hume that is usually given. So
right.
So then I left for the US. So I had this plan of going there for a year and do some research on the philosophy of economics. And I had an opportunity to go. It was an exchange program between my school and Harvard University. Mm-hmm. But then after a few months, I decided that there was no way I was going back to France. Very simply, I applied for every program in the U.S. and I was lucky to get in Harvard. And so I stayed there for about 6 years. I ended up changing completely my topic, right? I moved from the philosophy of economics to an epistemic defense of democracy. And this is actually a move that I suppose is due to the reformatting you go through when you go into a PhD in the US, where you're encouraged to develop your own ideas as opposed to criticizing those of other people. And so that's what happened to me. I thought, well, if I start criticizing economists, you know, economists are not going to listen to me. And philosophers are already, you know, in agreement that rational choice theory is a very reductive approach to human choices. So what's the point? And so I turned to other things. I discovered the Condorcet-Joubert theorem. And at the same time, I was really interested in deliberative theories of democracy. And so it all sort of combined together to make me. And I read David Estlin's work, of course, which was quite crucial.
Of course.
And so it all added up to this new approach.
Well, that's fantastic. And you know, one of the I think refreshing things about the book, Democratic Reason, is it's clear. I mean, I was not at all surprised when you were revealing your background in economics and more social scientific areas, because one of the nice things about the book is how driven it is by not only theoretical normative considerations about democratic theory and democratic authority and the institutions of democracy in an idealized sense, but the book really does get its hands dirty with a lot of the empirical results and a lot of the empirical material that deliberative democrats, I think, too often leave to somebody else.
Right.
If that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. Although I would say that democratic theory is actually a field in political theory where there is much more of an encounter between the empiricists and the sort of theorists than anywhere else, actually. So,
well, that seems right. Yeah. I was thinking particularly of democratic theory and philosophy departments.
Yes.
Where the empirical stuff is. Sometimes left to be discussed later in the day or the week. So that's all very fascinating. Let's pick up with the book then. So I'd like to, I guess naturally enough, begin at the very beginning. I guess that many of our listeners will be familiar with a standard line. And a very popular line of anti-democratic argument,
right,
that has an epistemic or a dimension or a concern with expertise. And it goes back to Plato, at least. And it says something very roughly now like the following. Politics or our collective lives maybe is something that's just too important for too important to be left to the stupid masses. And so the correct political order has to be one which empowers the knowers or the people who are most epistemically responsible. And that should be familiar to anybody who's read Plato, of course, as I mentioned. But as you note in your book, and one of the starting points of your book, is that the idea that democracy has distinctive epistemic benefits is a thought that goes back throughout democratic theory, and many democratic theorists have been keen to try to, as I said earlier, turn the tables on this anti-democratic argument. And the thought even goes back to Aristotle, mm-hmm. that there could be an epistemic benefit to a certain kind of group that outstrips the epistemic power of even the best person in the group. We find similar kinds of thoughts, namely that democracy has distinctive epistemic powers in democratic theorists or theorists as otherwise diverse as Spinoza, Rousseau, Mill, John Dewey, yeah. and even Hayek. And I think the book does a really nice job of sort of sorting all of those, that tradition or that genealogy, as you call it, out. Can we start there? Can you tell us a little bit about the genealogy, as you put it, of this epistemic approach to democratic theory?
Yes, sure. So it's an old idea, really, that actually goes back even further back to the Sophists, you might say.
Sure.
But Aristotle is the first to have clearly expressed it. So it's this famous passage from the Politics in Book 3, Chapter 11, where he writes. He has many passages where he talks about the superiority of democracy potentially through different metaphors, but the most famous one is certainly this one that compares democracy to a feast to which the many contribute. So it reads like this. The many who are not as individuals excellent men nevertheless can, when they have come together, be better than the few best people, not individually but collectively, just as feasts to which many contribute are better than feasts provided at one person's expense.
That's
and
right.
And it's an intuition that I think we can all understand and relate to, and it's just a little bit mysterious what's doing the work of ensuring that the party to which the many contribute is better than the party organized at the expense of just one person. And there are different ways to explain it. And what I try to say in this chapter is to say that some people attribute the epistemic properties to deliberation, so just the fact that we can exchange arguments among many people who come from different perspectives and bring different things to the table will ensure that the party has, you know, wine, beer, orange juice, all sorts of things, as opposed to just beer, maybe. And that the music is diverse as well. It's not just heavy metal. So I make this comparison, like if you're unlucky and it's a heavy metal fan who's organizing the party, it could be really bad. I mean, except for the minority who actually like that sort of party. So, right. So it's something about, you know, exchanging arguments and plans about how to make the party better, and distributing roles and responsibilities to the best effect. And then there are a more aggregative reading, which is just about, well, the probability that, as I said, only, you know, beer would be provided, or only heavy metal music would be provided. Whereas if you have a lot of people, the likelihood that all sorts of things will be, all sorts of different and pleasant things will be brought to the table is much more likely. So that's kind of like the two traditions I identify. People who identify the mechanism as deliberation, so I call them the talkers. And people who think it's who have this intuition that it's more about the sheer numbers, the law of large numbers, basically. And even if there's no exchange of arguments or reasons or information, you are still going to end up with something better. And these are the counters. If you will. Maybe we should specify what's meant by epistemic, actually, because I realize I'm sure this audience knows, but just to be clear, it means the knowledge aggregating properties of democracy, or also the truth tracking property. And then there's this whole issue of what we mean by that, but roughly that's what it means.
That's right. That's fine. So apart from Aristotle, though, can you tell us just a little bit about the way that this distinction between, as you put it, very helpfully, I should add, between talkers and counters, how does that play out in the history of democratic theory? Can you tell us a little bit about the ways in which this idea gets played out in later thinkers? And I'm thinking particularly of people like John Stuart Mill and John Dewey and Hayek.
Oh, so yeah. So first, I would say that the talkers are more numerous to a degree, because I think in order to account for the aggregative properties of democracy, you needed a concept of probability that became really available only late, like in basically the 18th century. And so there are more people on the side of the talker than there are on the side of the counters. And so on the side of the talker, so we have a lot of people, but John Stuart Mill is one very interesting figure, because I actually was not sure for a long time whether he counted as an epistemic democrat or an epistemic liberal. Right. And in fact, he's both, I believe. At the same time, he thinks that it's about letting the market of ideas sort of sort out the truth, right? Like if you let people who disagree talk things through freely, you at least ensure that even truths don't turn into dead dogmas, and so that the pool of arguments is constantly renewed and revivified. And so that's more a case for the epistemic properties of a liberal context, where people are free to speak. But then there's also this more democratic side to him, which is his defense of representative government, by which he really means strangely a participatory form of government, where it's government by discussion, and I think that's a connection with the talkers and other people who believe that it's deliberation among the many that's going to do the work of producing better laws and better outcomes.
Right, excellent. And is Hayek is Hayek a counter, or is Hayek? I'm wondering who might be a good example of a counter rather than a talker.
Well, a better example to me is Condorcet, right? Because he actually provides a really like the first very clear and rigorous version of the argument, right? He says that if you assume that for a given assembly of people, each individual has a better as a chance of getting to the right answers between two options better than 0.5, then when as the numbers of people grows larger, the majority is likely to be right with a probability of one, roughly. That's kind of the argument. Assuming other things, including the fact that people vote independently and they vote sincerely, and so there are a certain number of assumptions. So he has this like jury theorem, which is the formalization of that intuition that people like even Spinoza maybe had, but couldn't really explicit in a way he can, because he has now this concept of probability, which has become available since Pascal, more or less. And so that's the epitome of a counter for me. So Hayek for me doesn't actually count as an epistemic democrat per se, because his focus is on the market as opposed to an actual political collective decision procedure. So for me, I've come to realize that the story that Hayek gives us also involves the law of large numbers, and you know, it's all sorts of fascinating insight about the role of the invisible hand that regulates the markets and the mechanism of prices. But it's not the outcome of the market cannot really be appropriated by the public as such. It's the outcome of the market is a byproduct of is an unintentional byproduct of individual decisions that are not meant to be about something collective or something public like the common good. So I think for me it's a categorical mistake to compare the market and democracy. I think the comparison that I want to restrict myself to in that book, that I restrict myself to in that book, is between the rule of one, the rule of the few, and the rule of the many. And from that point of view, the question of the market is orthogonal. It's the market is a tool that can be used by the one, the few, or the many, but it's not in itself a political decision procedure.
Right. Excellent. So then let's move on then to the positive thesis in democratic theory that you're exploring in the book. And to put it very broadly, because there are lots of features of your view, the thought is that there is a distinctively epistemic argument in favor of democratic politics because democracy manifests or makes possible, we might say, a certain kind of expertise or a certain kind of knowledge. And it has to do, the argument does, with the claim that cognitive diversity is itself a certain kind of engine which makes for a unique kind of epistemic power. Could you spell that out a bit?
Yeah.
The connection between the epistemology and the truth trackingness and the getting things right and cognitive diversity?
Right. So the core of the argument, as you said, is a connection between numbers, including more people, and getting more of something which turns out to be key to collective intelligence, which is cognitive diversity. So what is cognitive diversity? So cognitive diversity, it's a sort of psychological concept, really. It's an internal it's the difference between the mental frameworks that people use to identify problems in the world and solve them. So it's mm-hmm. something that you can only understand differentially, so to speak, by comparing the way people approach problems. So it's a group property rather than a property of individuals. And I think to go back to the example of Plato and the anti-elitist tradition, right? I think their mistake was to assume that the intelligence of a group is a function uniquely of the intelligence of the members. When in fact it turns out that recent theories of collective intelligence tell us that the intelligence of a group, specifically of a problem-solving group, or a deliberating group is a function of two things, at least. So one is obviously the intuitive thing, which is the intelligence of the members. So you need members that are not too dumb for the group to be smart. But even more importantly, for the problem-solving group, you need groups that contain people that think differently, right? So that's a key argument. So and what I'm arguing, so my addendum to the, so that I'm borrowing that's theory really from the work of Scott Page, who with Lu Hong has put forward that diversity trumps ability theorem, where by which, you know, he proves that what matters more to the quality of the output of a problem-solving group is how diverse the members are in the way they approach the problem, rather than how smart they are, which is really a counterintuitive and very powerful result. And my addendum to that is to say, look, what is the most parsimonious way, or the cheapest way, or you know, the simplest way to maximize cognitive diversity, so diversity in the way people approach problems, given that you don't know ahead of time what the problems are going to be in that. So there's a strong hypothesis about the nature of political problems and the fact that politics is about collectively addressing the unknown, right? Well, I say the best or the cheapest way to get that cognitive diversity is to include everyone, because that's the only way you're sure that you're not going to miss out on a key perspective, because you don't know where the solution might come from. So that's sort of the argument. And
right. So let me just ask you to fill in just an important detail there about the nature of the cognitive diversity. So one of the things you said is we're talking about a cognitive diverse group is a cognitively diverse group is a group in which the members, as you just put it, think differently or invoke a different approaches to a problem. Right. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that kind of diversity amounts to?
Right. So maybe I can take the example from 12 Angry Men that I develop in the book. So
yes.
So the audience probably knows the story, but it's a group of 12 jurors who are locked up in a room on a hot summer day to sort out to figure out whether a young Puerto Rican accused of murder is guilty or not of killing his father. And what so the group is actually not all that diverse on the face of it. It's like 12 more or less white men. But they're sufficiently diverse from the perspective that matters. Like there is like an older man who's who's got the experience of, you know, age, and so can identify flaws in the testimony of one of the witnesses about the time it took him to cross the corridor and run to the door and see, because he claims to have seen the murderer. And then there's the perspective of somebody who has glasses, who can actually understand the meaning of the red sort of marks on the side of another key witness who said she also saw the murderer through a passing train when she was lying in bed. In fact, turns out that she most likely wears glasses, but she wasn't wearing them on the day she was testifying in front of the jury. So the cognitive diversity is always relative to the question at hand, but it's an internal it's neither the cognitive diversity should be distinguished from both its causes and its symptoms, if you will. So it's not gender diversity, it's not ethnic diversity. Those things, gender diversity, ethnic diversity, may cause cognitive diversity because it gives people different types of experiences in the world. But it's not the same as cognitive diversity. Cognitive diversity is really the process that goes on in people's heads when they consider data or arguments. And cognitive diversity is not either to be confused with its output, which is a diversity of views. That's the outcome, but really the cognitive diversity is about the process, if you will.
Right. So it's a kind of diversity of sensitivities to various kinds of data. Might that be a way to put it?
That you can put it that way. You can put it as you can define it as a prism. So you're going to see only certain facets of reality because you're more attuned to them through your personal experience, through maybe your gender, through, you know. So another way to look at it is as people having different models, different predictive models about the world. So, for example, when you talk about prediction and voting, for example, and we are trying to figure out who of two candidates is going to make the better president. So I may base my prediction on, you know, his charisma and the price of oil. And you may base your prediction on something completely different, like his competence on fiscal issues and the likelihood of a war with Iran or something like that. So that's cognitive diversity, because we're reading the world through completely different, using completely different variables.
Right. So let me just ask one additional question about something that comes up later in the book. I should mention, but it might be relevant here, about the connection between democratic and liberal institutions, because it seems then that part of what the epistemic argument that you're running requires is cognitive diversity, but it looks as if part of what cognitive diversity is about is not only having the different perspectives and the different approaches to problems, but also ensuring that the social order is structured such that people can make their contributions to collective decision processes, despite the fact that they might have in some cases, I guess, very obviously different approaches to problems. Is that a way to understand you say later in the book that a proper epistemic democracy has to be politically liberal. It has to be liberal in its institutions. Is this one of the places where that connection
Absolutely.
Gets drawn? Yeah.
No, I that's exactly right. Because even if, you know, I'm tempted to say that a normal population is cognitively diverse just because of the fact that people come up, are born equipped with different, you know, genetic makeup and different types of intelligences and different, and they're raised differently and all that. If you don't allow that diversity, that sort of innate diversity almost to flourish and be sort of empowering to people, then they might not express it. And what you want is for the political system to be able to tap it. And if you don't have this liberal background of rights like freedom of speech or a liberal education that encourages the expression of your own difference rather than conformism, then you will not get that cognitive diversity. Even if it's underlying, if it's there, it might not be expressed. So I think liberalism is a sort of a prerequisite. Yes.
Excellent. So now just keeping more or less continuous with the thought we were just discussing, you make a distinction between two distinct, though clearly they are related, mechanisms for reaping the epistemic powers of democracy, majority rule and inclusive deliberation. Can you talk a little bit about how these two mechanisms work and why they are distinct and how they're related?
Yes. So I like to use a metaphor there too, although I don't use it in the book, I believe, but I like to think of deliberation as the Swiss Army knife of the democratic toolbox, if you will, and majority rule as a scalpel. So by that, right. I mean that deliberation is a multifunction tool that does a lot of things, including identifying the problems and coming up with solutions, right? So it's a very flexible and multi-purpose tool. And majority rule, by contrast, is the thing we resort to when we're running out of time and we've not been able to settle on one decision or one outcome through deliberation, which is time consuming and doesn't always yield one single outcome. So then we turn to majority rule as a way to choose between the options laid out by deliberation. And so that's why, to me, from an epistemic point of view, at least, majority rule has only one function, which is predicting. Whereas deliberation has a function of sort of setting up the agenda and sort of creating solutions. And so these are two, instead of seeing them as competing tools, if you will, I see them as supplementary tools.
Can you say something a little bit further about majority rule is predicting. What does majority rule predict?
Well, so when we vote, so that's my reading of voting, right? So that on okay. one reading, so and again, I don't want to say that the epistemic approach tells you the whole story about democracy. So I do believe that a great amount of what we call democratic politics is simply about adjudicating fairly between competing interests, for example. Right. So there, one of the function of majority rule is simply to adjudicate fairly, right? We go with a larger number. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that the problems we're facing have an epistemic dimension, that is, are likely to have a better or worse answer, and the question is, okay, we have two candidates for president. Our goal here is not just to adjudicate fairly between, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats. It's also to identify who of the two is the better candidate. Simply, like from a factual point of view, almost. And there, I think majority rule makes it more likely that we're going to pick the right one.
Oh, I see. Okay, I see. Great. So let's pick up then on what you just touched on, which is the premise that seems to be underlying not only your epistemic conception of democracy, but any epistemic conception of democracy. And this is, I should mention, sort of a bone that gets picked between or amongst democratic theorists, which is the view that you call political cognitivism, which I take it is the commitment to the thought, as you just articulated it, that political outcomes or political judgments or maybe even expressions of political judgments are expressions that have what philosophers call cognitive content, by which we mean roughly they can be evaluated in sort of correct, you know, terms that evoke conceptions of correctness or truth and falsity or justifiedness. I take it that a lot of our listeners will know that there are pretty formidable expanses within political democratic theory that try to eschew this commitment. They want to say things like democracy is simply about, as you said earlier, adjudicating conflicting interests. There's nothing to evaluate in terms of correctness there. It's just, you know, how do we hammer out a solution given the fact that people want different things? But the epistemic cases are always going to, I think, have to invoke some standard or some conception, I should say, about correctness. So the book, the final full chapter of the book, that is the final chapter before your concluding chapter, is a defense of political cognitivism. Right. And so could you tell us a little bit about that issue, which is a huge conglomerate of many issues, and your own defense? Right.
So it's a huge issue, in part a little bit contingently, I think, in political science. I think there has been a rejection of the concept of truth and the idea that there can be better and worse answers in politics, which I think it's just historically very contingent, but really it's not that demanding. The idea is simply to ask, do we think that it's possible to make mistakes in politics? When we vote, when we deliberate, can we sometimes make mistakes? And I think anyone has to agree that yes, that, I mean, there's no question. It's not just a matter of we chose to drive on the left or on the right, in which case there's no better or worse answer, really. It just matters that we coordinate on some side. No, they are objectively wrong and objectively right, answers in politics. So, for example, think of European democracy's appeasement strategy toward Hitler, or the Bay of Pigs disaster, or even more recently, some aspects of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. I mean, clearly, by factual and moral standards, some of the decision can arguably be said to have been mistakes. So, in a way, that's all I need for political cognitivism. I don't think epistemic Democrats have to necessarily commit to something more. That's what usually they're cornered into doing. Like, you know, the opponents want to make us say that we believe in some Platonic standard of truth that's like universal and absolute and real in some concrete ways, in some objective way. And I think, in fact, all you need to assume is that it's a very Habermasian move in a way that when we deliberate, it wouldn't make any sense for us to deliberate and exchange reasons if we were not trying to figure out something like the right answer or the better answer.
Right. And just to pick up on the invocation of Plato, there is another kind of Platonic charge that's associated sort of famously with Hannah Arendt, that once you admit a concept of truth into your political philosophy, the philosophy becomes Platonic in a different sense. It becomes tyrannical, that truth is a tyrant's concept, and it's a fundamentally anti-democratic component of a political theory. Could you spell that out a little
bit? Right. So yes, so Arendt and I would say Rawls are the two sort of influential authors that have sort of made this association between truth and I'm tempted to say terrorism or some kind of tyrannical politics. And again, I think it's contingent. Arendt was clearly writing in the shadow of Second World War, and for Rawls, the sort of worry was about, you know, the wars of religion and all the truth claims that had been used to oppress and tyrannize. And I just argue there that we can absolutely decouple the notion of truth and the notion of coercive politics. They don't have to go together. And another way to put it is that, in fact, truth is not the cause, the concept of truth when we use it, when we make truth claims, this is not the cause of our disagreements. It's just a way of expressing them. And if you do the Rawlsian move of replacing truth with a substitute concept like the reasonable, in a way, it's an illusion to think it solves anything, because we're going to disagree as well about what's the most reasonable solution. So we're going to run again into the same kind of disagreements that truth or the reasonable express as opposed to cause, and it's not going to solve it. So in the end, it's a little bit semantic. If you are very uncomfortable with the concept of truth, you can decide not to use it and replace it by the reasonable or the right or the better or something like that. But at the end of the day, you need some kind of procedure independent standard of correctness to be able to say that one solution is better than another.
Right. It's perfect. So you, in giving examples about political errors as as showing that everybody thinks it's possible to make mistakes in politics, you were talking primarily about kinds of examples that looked as if the error lied in some kind of factual miscalculation about the number of troops or about the likely outcome of appeasement.
Right.
I take it that in the chapter on in defending political cognitivism, you make a very nice distinction between factual disagreements over values that have a factual component, and then on the third hand, disagreements over what you call basic or fundamental values that may not have
right.
A factual component. Can you give us some details on how that distinction plays out?
So I'd rather give you maybe examples of I think it's harder to give example there because they're bound to be extremely controversial. But I would say
sure.
that example of even fundamental moral principle where we can say that we've come to a conclusion that that was the right move. It's for example saying that slavery is wrong. That there was a
right.
time, right, in history where this was not an obvious claim. And but that, I think, is a case of almost pure pure value that is obviously right. And I think it's hard to disagree with that. I think in the same category, you could probably find gay marriage, or it's much more recent. And again, it's harder to make the case for that. But yes, I want to make the claim that moral political cognitivism is not just about facts; it's also about values, and it might even be about fundamental values. Although there, I'm a little bit more cautious, and I'm happy to have a sort of intermediate position where I grant that yes, maybe at the level of fundamental basic values, it's all about adjudicating fairly between our competing views.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I mean, you can have a minimal or a maximal version of political cognitivism that way, and I don't really choose
right.
there.
Right. So one further detail on this, you could tell that this is the part of the book that I'm personally, for better or worse, really, really interested in. The reference that you made a minute ago to sort of a procedure independent criterion, can you tell us about that? Because I suspect that that's what drives some of the worry that that truth has to, in democratic politics, truth has got some kind of tyrannical implication. That is, that there's a right answer that can be discerned independently of democratic processes, and that I take it the Arendt thought, or the kind of thought that Arendt is giving voice to there, is the thought that, well, once we admit that there's a kind of correctness that is accessible, potentially at least, independently of democratic procedures, we might discover some non-democratic procedure that's better at delivering or discovering or discerning those truths, and then democracy would be in peril by the concept of truth. So what do you mean by the procedure-independent standard of correctness?
Right. So first of all, what I don't mean is that it's entirely independent standard of correctness in the sense of a real universal absolute kind of standard, right? It's not the Platonic standard. It's just independent of the procedure. So it's not defined by the procedure in the sense that in conception of pure procedural justice, for example, you know, whatever the outcome of the throw of a dice is, that defines the right outcome. No, it's about there is something independently of the procedure that is just or right, and the procedure is an imperfect way for us to get at it. So now, indeed, the worry is that there are actually a bunch of worries. I mean, even if you assume that there is such an independent standard of correctness, you might say, well, maybe it exists, but we don't have a way to verify it. So, what's the point of talking about political cognitivism? That's sort of the Jeremy Waldron attitude to the question, I suppose. And then you have the other worry, which is, well, if there was such a thing and we could independently verify it, then we would no longer need democratic procedure to get there. And especially if this alternative route is through experts then the case for democracy is weakened as a result. It seems to open the door to a defense of expertocracy, right? Or epistocracy, as Eastland puts it. So my answer to that is that, to the latter point is that there are no experts that can sort of take the shortcut. The only thing that could take us for me, the answers are hidden behind the veil of the future in politics. So, for example, on the Iraq war, at the time when the decision was made, I think we were, you know, under the burdens of judgment and the burdens of reason. So it was very, very hard to figure out the truth. But now, with this sort of time has passed, and we've got access to more knowledge about the circumstances in which the decision was made, etc. So I think that's what social sciences and history are about. We look back and we can figure out, not perfectly, but pretty close, whether something was a good or a bad answer. So if we had a time machine, then we would have this like secondary route at the time when we make the decision to make it, right? But we don't. So there's no short-circuiting the democratic route in a way. Because truth reveals itself sort of in a lagged manner, right? So that's the sort of way I have of answering the question of we would no longer need democratic procedures to get there. No, we do, because we are bound by time constraints. We have to make a decision at time T. And if truth gets revealed only 10 years down the road, it won't help us.
Right, right. Excellent. You've been very generous with your time. I just wanted to thank you again for appearing on New Books in Philosophy. And I usually end up with a question about what you're doing next. So, Elaine, what's next on the horizon for you?
So my next project is actually also in democratic theory, but it's a very different approach. So what I've done so far is very a priori and in deductive. And what I'm interested in doing now is much more inductive. So I want to look at various democratic innovations that try to tap the collective intelligence of the people and sort of see how, you know, new forms of direct and participatory democracy can guide us about what I'd like to call democracy 3.0 and the principles behind it, right? I think we are in a transition phase away from representative government and towards something very different. And so I'm not prejudging the conclusion just yet. I just have this intuition that if you look at things like the Icelandic case recently of this nation that decided to rewrite their foundational social contract, right, through participatory and inclusive methods, it's something completely new. It's something we representative government as a concept cannot account for. And so similarly, I'm involved in a project with the Finnish government where we are crowdsourcing part of the process of a law reform on snowmobile regulation. And so it raises questions about the meaning of representation that are, you know, legitimacy, all sorts of things that we need a new framework really to understand, I think. So I want to also look at, participatory budgeting in Brazil, and also workplace democracy, because I think it's not just about change, introducing new principles or discovering new principles of democracy. It's also about expanding the domain of democracy. I think we've been narrowly focused on what we call the political or the public, when in fact there's also this this domain of the economic sphere where we've bracketed the democratic question, but in fact it's becoming urgent and burning for a lot of people.
Right, and so let me just ask a philosophical question. So, do you see the fate, as it were, of the epistemic properties of democracy to sort of depend upon the depth of our democratic ethos, as it were? That is, I take it that in a lot of epistemic stories, democracy has to be understood not simply as a kind of government, but as a social order, and in which, you know, collective deliberation has to have a further reach, yes, than simply to the state. Is that along the lines?
That is absolutely true. And I think we have not exploited at all the potential of democratic reason, if you will. That there is so much more that citizens could do to help improve the governmental decisions and policies. And so I think it's a little bit of a way of life and ethos. It's way more than just voting, you know, once every 4 years.
Well, that sounds excellent, and the projects all sound very, very interesting, and it's refreshing, I should say, to hear that you're engaged in these real world inquiries about the democratic potential that is, I think, so far untapped in some of the technological changes that have occurred in the past 15 years or so with our communications technology and the rest. So all that sounds wonderful, and I will keep an eye out for future work, and maybe we'll have you back on the podcast to talk about your next
book. That would be wonderful. Yes.
Well, in between then and now, let me just thank you, Elaine Landemore, for joining us on New Books in Philosophy to talk about your book, Democratic Reason.
Thank you, Bob.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Elaine Landemore of Yale University. We were talking about her new book, Democratic Reason, Politics, Collective Intelligence, and the Rule of the Many, which is newly published by Princeton University Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.